Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, February 11th, 2021. House Democrats prosecuting the impeachment of former President Donald Trump, concluding their presentation of evidence in the Senate. The Democrats saying the rioters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th did so on Donald Trump's orders. And the former president has shown no remorse for the damage he did to people's lives, to the faith in the constitutional process, and the emboldened violent extremists. And if given the chance, he'd do it again. Coming up, the impeachment managers, and we'll talk with Washington Post reporter Olivier Knox about the case against the former president and how his legal team might respond. Also today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying Capitol Police and other law enforcement who protected the Capitol that day will receive the Congressional Gold Medal. Some of the officers died, Pelosi calling them martyrs for our democracy. President Joe Biden meeting at the White House with a bipartisan group of senators talking about infrastructure spending. And also the phone call that he had Wednesday night with the Chinese President Xi Jinping saying if we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch. President Biden also going to Bethesda, Maryland to visit the National Institutes of Health, getting a briefing on coronavirus vaccine research. And now to the impeachment trial. Lead manager Jamie Raskin saying that former President Trump knew he was inciting an insurrection on January 6th because he had done things like that in the past, including an armed occupation of Michigan's state capitol and a plot to kidnap the governor, Gretchen Whitmer. Raskin called those attacks a dress rehearsal for January 6th. Raskin also concluding the day by asking, what greater offense could one commit than to incite a violent insurrection at our seat of government during the peaceful transition of power? And what is impeachable conduct, if not this?
These prior acts of incitement cast a harsh light on Trump's obvious intent, his unavoidable knowledge of the consequences of his incitement. And the clear foreseeability of the violent harm that he unleashed on our people and our republic. January 6th was not some unexpected radical break from his normal law-abiding and peaceful disposition. This was his state of mind. This was his essential MO. He knew that egged on by his tweets, his lies, and his promise of a wild time in Washington to guarantee his grip on power, his most extreme followers would show up bright and early, ready to attack, ready to engage in violence, ready to fight like hell for their hero, just like they'd answered his call in Michigan. President Trump has said over and over his supporters are loyal. In his own words, his supporters are the most loyal that we've seen in our country's history. And he knew that his most hardcore supporters were willing to direct violence at elected officials, indeed to attack and lay siege to a Capitol building. And he knew they would be ready to heed his call on January 6th to stop the steal by using violence to block the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. He knew they were coming. He brought them here. And he welcomed them with open arms. We hear you and love you from the Oval Office. My dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, the lead House impeachment manager. As he ended the day's arguments, he referred to a founding father of the United States.
You know, when Tom Paine wrote Common Sense, the pamphlet that launched the American Revolution, he said that common sense really meant two different things. One, common sense is the understanding that we all have without advanced learning and education. Common sense is the sense accessible to everybody. But common sense is also the sense that we all have in common as a community. Senators, America, we need to exercise our common sense about what happened. Let's not get caught up in a lot of outlandish lawyers' theories here. Exercise your common sense about what just took place in our country. Tom Paine wasn't an American, as you know, but he came over to help us in our great revolutionary struggle against the kings and queens and the tyrants. And in 1776, in the crisis, he wrote these beautiful words. It was a very tough time for the country. People didn't know which way things were going to go. Were we going to win? Against all hope? Because for most of the rest of human history, it had been the kings and the queens and the tyrants and the nobles lording it over the common people. Could political self-government work in America was the question. And Paine wrote this pamphlet called The Crisis. And in it, he said these beautiful words. And with your permission, I'm going to update the language a little bit pursuant to a suggestion of Speaker Pelosi so as not to offend modern sensibilities. Okay, but he said, these are the times that try men and women's souls. These are the times that try men and women's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will shrink at this moment from the service of their cause and their country. But everyone who stands with us now will win the love and the favor and the affection of every man and every woman for all time. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered, but we have this saving consolation. The more difficult the struggle, the more glorious in the end will be our victory.
Congressman Jamie Raskin is a Democrat from Maryland, the lead House impeachment manager today on the Senate floor during the impeachment trial. Another manager, Ted Lieu of California, focusing on how former President Donald Trump reacted when the rioting began on January 6th, saying that the president did not show remorse by tweeting a video that day that told the protesters to go home, but also called them very special people. And even in a video a week later, Donald Trump condemning the attack, but again, not expressing remorse. Here is Congressman Ted Lieu.
Now, no one is saying here that President Trump cannot contest the election. Of course he can. But what President Trump did, as his former chief of staff explained, was different. It was dishonorable, it was un-American, and it resulted in fatalities. President Trump spent months inflaming his supporters, spread lies to incite a violent attack on the Capitol, on our law enforcement, and on all of us. And then he lied again to his base to tell them that this was all okay, that this was all acceptable. And that is why President Trump is so dangerous. Because he would have all of us, all Americans, believe that any president who comes after him can do exactly the same thing. That's why lack of remorse is an important factor in impeachment. Because impeachment, conviction, and disqualification is not just about the past, it's about the future. It's making sure that no future official, no future president does the same exact thing President Trump does. President Trump's lack of remorse shows that he will undoubtedly cause future harm if allowed, because he still refuses to account for his previous high grave crime against our government. You know, I'm not afraid of Donald Trump running again in 4 years. I'm afraid he's going to run again and lose, because he can do this again.
House impeachment manager Ted Lieu. Another manager, David Cicilline, looked at the physical and emotional toll the January 6th attack took on members of Congress and police and media and support staff that were in the Capitol building, and also the toll it took on faith in the democratic institutions of the country. Congressman Cicilline reminding senators that the first three people in line for succession for the presidency were in the building at the time: Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and the Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Grassley.
Dawn Bancroft and Diane Santos Smith, two of the rioters charged in the attack, were caught on tape discussing the brutal violence that they hoped to inflict on Speaker Pelosi had she not been rushed out to safety. They said, quote, "We broke into the Capitol. We got inside. We did our part. We were looking for Nancy to shoot her in the frigging brain, but we didn't find her," end quote. Senators, simply put, this mob was trying to overthrow our government. And they came perilously close to reaching the first three people in line to the presidency. It wasn't just the vice president and the speaker. Rioters were prepared to attack any member of Congress they found. Thomas Edward Caldwell, Donovan Ray Kroll, and Jessica Marie Watkins, three militia members, were also charged for their role in the attack. They discussed trapping us inside the underground tunnels. The indictment quotes social media chatter with Caldwell, quote, "All members are in the tunnel under Capitol. Seal them in. Turn on gas. All legislators are down in the tunnels, three floors down. Do like we had to do when I was in the Corps and start tearing out floors. Go from top to bottom," end quote. Never did any of us imagine that we or our colleagues would face mortal peril by a mob riled up by the President of the United States, the leader of the free world. But we did, all because Donald Trump could not accept his election defeat. Trump chose himself above the people, above our institutions, above our democracy, above all of you.
Democrat David Cicilline, one of nine House impeachment managers before the senators today, finishing up their case. They had up to 8 hours today, did not use it all. They had 8 hours available yesterday, didn't use it all as well. On Friday, Donald Trump's lawyers begin the rebuttal. One of them, David Schoen, was interviewed this afternoon on Fox News.
Do you expect to have it wrapped up tomorrow?
Well, we'll see how that goes, but there's no reason for us to be out there a long time. As I said from the start of this thing, this trial never should have happened, and if it happened, it should be as short as possible, given the complete lack of evidence and the harm that this is causing to the American people. I said when I spoke earlier that this is the antithesis of a process that would lead to healing or unity or accountability. It's the antithesis of it. It tears the country apart. Do you think it leads to healing, to show and reshow the tragedy that happened here at the Capitol, lives lost, that had nothing whatsoever to do with President Trump, but they want you to believe that it did?
Well, they are making their case using video. They're repeating the president's own words, David, to fight like hell, he told his supporters in Washington that day as they planned their walk to the Capitol. The Wall Street Journal this morning has a piece out, Trump legal team weighs recasting its defense in this Senate trial. It points to Castor's meandering message, as it describes, or presentation that we saw on Tuesday, his opening remarks, that many Republicans even appeared boggled by what they saw. There. Has there been a change in legal strategy? What will we see tomorrow?
No change in legal strategy. Listen, Mr. Castor got up the first day. He jumped right into it to respond to something that had been said. I think he's been very, very unfairly maligned, frankly. He's a lawyer with a long 35 years of experience or so. And let's just see how this thing plays out. Tomorrow's our opportunity to go. That's when we start to present our case and to give answers. You know, it's like any sporting event or any trial. When you watch one side, it seems you hear their evidence. But if you really watch this side analytically, you'll see that there's no tie whatsoever to the speech. If you look at the words of the speech, why do we ignore the word peacefully? Why do we ignore the context in which the word fight is used during the course of it to cheer on legislators to have courage and that sort of thing? Let's take a look at what we present in our case starting tomorrow.
David, how big a hill do you think you have to climb? And I ask that question because Senator John Thune of South Dakota, who's number two in the Senate Republican leadership, said of the Democratic House manager's presentation, he thought it was a strong presentation put together in a way I think makes it very compelling. He also said they have done a good job at connecting the dots. And then President Biden said today, I think minds could have been changed.
Well, it's very important to listen to what the senators say, so it's important to have that message. But, you know, this is what you get when you bring in a movie company and hire a large law firm to make a professional product that takes things out of context and presents it as an entertainment package. And what I said from the start is, this isn't a blood sport. It's not about entertainment. It's about reporting the facts to the American people. So if you look at their sources for the information that what they would suggest is compelling, they have such sources as reportedly or sources. That's part of the problem with a lack of complete lack of due process, no investigation in this case, and no opportunity to test the evidence in this case. In no setting in this country where someone's guilt or innocence is being adjudicated would this kind of approach be permitted. That's why we have rules against things like hearsay and other require other indicia of credibility and reliability. But here, for an impeachment process, it's offensive.
David Schoen, one of former President Donald Trump's attorneys, today on Fox News. With more on the Senate impeachment trial, joining us now on the phone is Olivier Knox, Washington Post political reporter and author of the Daily 202 newsletter. Thanks for being with us. The House managers concluding their arguments. How do you think it went?
Well, one of the really striking things about today's procedure was how it underlined the absence of flesh and blood witnesses in this case against Donald Trump. You know, the House managers today played audio and showed tweets from a number of Republicans. You saw Republican governors, Republican lawmakers, Chris Christie, a number of other folks laying the blame for the riot of January 6th at the Capitol squarely on Donald Trump. But there were still some gaps. There's still some things that we don't know that might have been better fleshed out by actual flesh and blood witnesses. Notably, what was going on at 1600 Pennsylvania from, you know, about 1:30 p.m. or 2 p.m. To about 4 p.m. There are some gaps. There's some good reporting about it, but it would have been nice to have that in the record. The other thing I thought was notable today, they've been trying, the managers have, to make this, to take some of the partisan edge off this impeachment trial. And today their argument was they're not punishing Donald Trump. What they're trying to do is make sure that this kind of situation doesn't come up again. Congresswoman DeGette saying at one point, this is not to punish, it is to prevent not just Donald Trump, but future presidents from being tempted to unleash politically driven violence. So it's been interesting to watch. The question, of course, is how many minds have been changed on the Republican side of the aisle. And we're not going to know that until the very end.
On that question of witnesses, I've seen some reporting that a number of Democratic senators are saying that they don't think they're necessary. Dick Durbin, Chris Coons have been quoted.
Sure. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One, it's been said since before the start of the trial that the senators aren't just sitting in judgment. They also were in the Capitol on January 6th. So they are witnesses and victims and the rest of it. You can certainly make that argument. I mean, both sides have. The Democrats are saying, you know, the evidence is plain. And Republicans are saying there is no evidence. And so you have a situation in which they kind of agree. I'm just telling you that as a reporter, there are gaps here that I think would have been better fleshed out with actual human witnesses.
Today's presentation by the House managers didn't have as much drama as what they did on Wednesday when they were showing that never-before-seen security video from the Capitol. What kind of impact did that have?
Oh, I thought those videos were incredible. You know, these silent security videos throughout the Capitol catching these just amazing moments of, you know, a Capitol police officer turning Mitt Romney around and getting him to run in the direction opposite where the mob was coming from. Chuck Schumer and his security detail, you know, hustling up a ramp inside the Capitol and then racing back down it, apparently in the face of some kind of threat. The body camera from the Capitol police officer beat with hockey sticks and poles. I mean, that was extremely dramatic. We heard and saw some senators on the Republican side be visibly upset. James Lankford was visibly upset by some of this footage. It was obviously enormously emotional, and part of what the managers have been trying to do a little bit less today, but part of what they've been trying to do is sort of counter the cooling off that has happened since January 6th. In the immediate aftermath of January 6th, you had some people on the Republican side, fairly directly blaming Donald Trump. And then as the weeks went by, they sort of cooled off. And this was sort of an effort to bring the temperature back up, to remind them what it was like, to remind them what happened. And in the case of the never-before-seen footage, make people realize this was much worse than what we saw on cable TV on January 6th. And it could have been much worse than that.
We're talking with Olivier Knox from The Washington Post. The former president's legal team will start on Friday. Today, the House impeachment managers sought to try to preempt some of the expected arguments, particularly free speech. Do you think that's going to be the center of the arguments of the president's team?
No, I don't. I think it's going to be an argument that they make. I think they're going to try to counter what the House managers did today. The House managers today tried to connect the former president closely to the violence of January 6th. You know, it's at the heart of the article of impeachment, incitement to insurrection. So they try to work out how over many months there was a pattern of Donald Trump encouraging violence by his supporters. They referred to one incident at the Capitol in Michigan as a dress rehearsal for what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. So they spent a lot of their day trying to tie Donald Trump as closely as possible to this riot. And he knew what he was doing. He did it deliberately. And I think what the defense is going to be arguing is, you know, there's not that much of a direct link between the president and these rioters. Sure, he said you have to fight like hell. But look, all these other Democrats have used the expression fight like hell in political context. And we're not charging them with anything. So I think it's going to be more like that. They will make the free speech argument for sure. But I think they're more likely to focus on this idea that the managers just have not proven that Donald Trump's words inspired the crowd.
And finally, we mentioned the trial moving a little bit faster than originally laid out. This could end over the weekend. 17 Republicans would have to join the Democrats. Is it feasible?
Well, we certainly haven't seen any signs that it's going to happen. I mean, in the test votes that we've had to date, we have not seen anything close to the 17 Republicans lining up to convict Donald Trump. I still think it's just. I mean, my crystal ball is cloudy. I'm not oracular by any stretch of the imagination. It just seems so unlikely when the overwhelming majority of Republicans voted to say that the entire process was unconstitutional. What are they going to do now? Turn around and convict him in a process they've called unconstitutional? It seems like a bit of a stretch.
Olivier Knox, Washington Post political reporter, also author of the Daily 202 newsletter. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And one of those Republican senators who voted to say the impeachment trial was unconstitutional because Donald Trump is no longer in office, Josh Hawley of Missouri. And he was on Fox News this morning talking about what he has seen so far in the trial.
Well, I think what we're watching is a total kangaroo court. It is an illegitimate proceeding. It is unconstitutional. If you want to see the proof of that, Harris, just look at what happened last night when Senator Mike Lee pointed out that the House managers had blatantly misquoted him. He tried to get it stricken from the record, and what ensued was chaos on the Senate floor as Senator Leahy first ordered a vote, then stopped the vote in the middle because Chuck Schumer intervened to ask him, oh, wait a minute, don't do the vote. Total chaos and pandemonium. They are making this up as they go along. It's totally unconstitutional, and it is incredibly selfish on the part of the Democrats who are pursuing their own personal political vendettas here. You know, they need to take seriously their oath of office and start focusing on the American people and doing what is good for them, not just what pleases the Democrats in this moment. And this is a total kangaroo trial.
Senator Josh Hawley, Republican on Fox News. New York Times explaining what Senator Hawley was referencing. They write, in the final hour of arguments on Wednesday, Representative David Cicilline, Democrat of Rhode Island and one of the impeachment managers, spoke of Mr. Trump mistakenly calling Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, in an effort to reach Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. In describing the call, which was detailed in news reports, Mr. Cicilline asserted that Mr. Lee had stood by as Mr. Trump asked Mr. Tuberville to make additional objections to the certification of President Biden's electoral votes. This was all while the riot was happening. Senator Mike Lee saying that it was an inaccurate description. Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island asked on MSNBC Wednesday night about the position senators like Josh Hawley are taking towards this impeachment trial.
Do you have the feeling that there are some Republican members of the Senate, highly recognizable, like Senator Cruz, possibly Senator Hawley, who gave them, the big fist sign earlier in the day on January 6th, who are sitting there in the Senate never having felt threatened by this crowd at all at any moment because they knew that that crowd knew that they were on their side?
Well, what I think of with them is we're still looking at what their role was in all of this. We've made the referral to the Ethics Commission, Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee is going to have its look. But when you look at the evidence today about the president's call to Senator Tuberville, asking him to delay the proceedings, to add objections, to spread it out, you can see that it's like a pincer move. On the one hand, you're getting your mob up to the Capitol to do this damage and to disrupt the counting of the electoral votes. But at the same time, you've got to open the window of time during which those electoral votes are counted in order to allow the mob to have its effect, to actually do the damage, to perhaps catch someone, but at a minimum, to be able to disrupt. If this thing had gone smoothly and orderly and without objection, we might have been done by the time the mob had breached the Capitol. So there's a possibility of there having been some connivance between those who tried to create the delay and that being used to open a window long enough that the mob could fight its way in and disrupt the count. So all of that remains to be seen. But that it struck me that when the president called Senator Tuberville for that specific purpose, that could easily have been a similar call to another colleague.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat, questioned by MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell Wednesday night. The impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, continues on Friday at noon Eastern. Live coverage on C-SPAN Radio, C-SPAN 2 Television. Listen anywhere in the free C-SPAN Radio app. More on the trial and reaction from President Joe Biden and a move by Speaker Nancy Pelosi when Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. President Joe Biden rescinding the emergency order used by former President Trump to justify construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall. But the Pentagon says the 3,600 U.S. troops or so deployed to the border won't be coming home or away from the border anytime soon. Department of Housing and Urban Development will begin investigating complaints of housing discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity under the Fair Housing Act. Another reversal of policy from the Trump administration. And on Capitol Hill, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee approving two more cabinet nominations. Miguel Cardona for Education Secretary. The vote was 17-5 to send it to the full Senate. And Marty Walsh for Labor Secretary. That vote out of committee was 18-4. In both cases, the no votes, all from Republicans. CNN reporting that President Biden said Thursday that he watched news coverage of Wednesday's impeachment trial, predicting that some minds may be changed in the Senate as Republicans weigh whether to vote to convict amid powerful video evidence presented by House impeachment managers. The president was responding to a reporter's question during a White House Oval Office meeting.
I told you what I'm focused on. My job is to deal with the promises I made, and we all know we have to move on. Today, it's about jobs and infrastructure. I, like other Americans, watched the news. I didn't watch any of the hearing live because I was going straight through last night till a little after 9. But I watched some this morning. I think the Senate has a very important job to complete. And I think my guess is some minds may have been changed, but I don't know.
President Biden during a meeting at the White House with both Democrat and Republican senators. This from the Hill newspaper. Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing Thursday the Democrats will soon grant the Congressional Gold Medal to the officers on duty guarding the Capitol when it was attacked on January 6th. In a Dear Colleague letter, Pelosi praising those officers, members of the U.S. Capitol Police, the D.C. Metro Police, and others as heroes. The speaker spoke about this during her weekly news conference.
This week, as you know, we have seen it's been such a sad time for us. But at this, as we see what is being presented, we also see the extraordinary valor of the Capitol Police, who risked and gave their lives to save our Capitol, our democracy, our lives. They were martyrs for our democracy. Martyrs for our democracy, those who lost their lives. That is why I am putting forth a resolution introducing legislation to pay tribute to the Capitol Police and other law enforcement personnel who protected the Capitol by giving them a Congressional Gold Medal, the highest honor that Congress can bestow. The service of the Capitol Police Force that day brings honor to our democracy. Their accepting this reward brings luster to this medal. We must always remember their sacrifice and stay vigilant against what I've said before about what Abraham Lincoln said, the silent artillery of time. We will never forget. We were so moved by having the family give us the honor of honoring Brian Sicknick. Also, the Libman Good family and the Smith family, we share their grief, and we want to recognize the valor of that. And then also, of course, Officer Goodman for his valor. But these are demonstrations of much more bravery throughout the Capitol on that sad day. So we want to honor them in the best way that we possibly can, and we will continue to do so beyond a medal, but in our hearts.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick died from injuries he sustained during the attack January 6th. Two other officers mentioned took their own lives after the attack. On another issue, Speaker Pelosi said that President Biden will not be addressing a joint session of Congress until after a coronavirus relief bill is passed, and then only after the sergeant-at-arms and attending physician make recommendations about how to have a joint session safely, both in terms of physical safety and the coronavirus pandemic. Back to the White House, the president's meeting with senators on infrastructure, the president speaking about that phone call he had Wednesday night with the president of China, the first between the two leaders since President Biden took office.
Last night, I was on the phone for two straight hours with Xi Jinping. And you all know as well as I do, these folks, and it was a good conversation. I know him well. We spent a lot of time together over the years I was vice president. And we don't get moving. They're going to eat our lunch. They have major new initiatives on rail, and they already have rail that goes 225 miles an hour with ease. They're working very hard to do what I think we're going to have to do. And I think the automobile industry is already there, and so is labor. They're working very hard to try to move in a position where they end up being the source of a new way in which to power automobiles, they're going to invest a lot of money. They're investing billions of dollars in dealing with a whole range of issues that relate to transportation, the environment, and a whole range of other things. So we just have to step up. And so what I'm going to talk to these folks about, since they're the key committee, is how we begin this. I've laid out what I think I have to do. We should be doing. They have a plan as well within their jurisdiction. But they're also very, very competent senators who know a lot more than beyond their jurisdiction about the things it needs. So I'm looking for a wholesome conversation, or fulsome conversation. So thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
President Joe Biden in the White House Oval Office. He mentioned the auto industry. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki saying the president is planning to sign an executive order in the coming weeks to address the shortage of semiconductors, or chips, which has led to several car companies temporarily shutting down assembly lines. And on the president's phone call with the Chinese president, a White House summary mentions that the leaders spoke about Beijing's coercive and unfair economic practices, crackdown in Hong Kong, human rights abuses, and also Taiwan. And also this, the shared challenges of global health security, climate change, and preventing weapons proliferation. On coronavirus, Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor to the president, predicting by April it's going to be open season for vaccinations in the U.S. as supply boosts allow most people to get shots to protect against COVID-19. Dr. Fauci was on NBC's Today show. President Biden today went to NIH, National Institute of Health, in Bethesda, Maryland, to tour the Vaccine Research Center, also made some remarks.
Another point of progress is we're deploying more vaccinators. We're now allowing retired doctors and nurses to come back and administer shots. We're deploying federal vaccinators, and over the last 3 weeks, we put hundreds of new vaccinators in the field and are lining up thousands more. These include medical personnel from our Commissioned Corps at the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as personnel from FEMA, the Defense Department, and more departments to come. All told, we are on track to surpass the goal I set on day one. When I was sworn in, I indicated, just before I was sworn in, I indicated that my hope was to administer 100 million shots in the first 100 days of our term. I believe we'll not only reach that, but we'll break that. But like I said before, that's just the floor. That's just the floor. Our end goal is beating COVID-19, which brings us to the challenge that remains. We remain in the teeth of this pandemic. January of 2021 was the deadliest month we've had. We lost over 100,000 of our fellow citizens. We're on track to cross 500,000 dead Americans this next month. The new strains emerging create immense challenges, and masking is still the easiest thing to do to save lives. But we need everyone to mask up. And by the way, I know it's a pain in the neck, but it's a patriotic responsibility. We're in the middle of a war with this virus. It's a patriotic responsibility. Not only if you care about your family, you care about your fellow Americans.
President Joe Biden at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland, Bethesda, just outside of Washington, D.C., also announcing his administration has secured 200 million more COVID-19 vaccine doses from Moderna and Pfizer. Also today, the White House said it's not made any final decisions on imposing domestic travel restrictions due to the virus. Miami Herald report from Wednesday said that the administration was weighing domestic travel restrictions to target states that have been severely impacted by variants, including Florida and California. On Wall Street today, the Dow down 7, NASDAQ up 53, S&P up 6. On Capitol Hill, the House Ways and Means Committee continuing a markup session for a second day on the budget resolution for the next fiscal year. That's the vehicle that is going to include the large coronavirus economic aid package. President Biden wants $1.9 trillion. That includes direct stimulus payments of $1,400, plus enhanced federal unemployment insurance, additional funding for programs related to vulnerable populations, the elderly, skilled nursing facilities, and also dealing with pension plans, among a number of other issues. One amendment today put forth by Republican Jackie Walorski of Indiana said that no funds in this bill can be used towards abortions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe every human life is precious and absolutely should not be forced, taxpayers should not be forced to pay for the destruction of life. That's why House Republicans have been united in our efforts to protect the unborn and prevent taxpayer funding for abortion. A majority of Americans, nearly 60%, agree that tax dollars should not be used to fund elective abortions. The Hyde Amendment has been in place for nearly half a century with bipartisan agreement, saving the lives of more than 2 million innocent babies and protecting Americans' conscious rights. My amendment will preserve this important pro-life safeguard by adding long-standing Hyde protections to this subtitle. This will make clear that a taxpayer-subsidized COBRA plan won't be used to pay for elective abortions. It would also give issuers the chance to instead provide COBRA-eligible plan options that comply with the Hyde Amendment. We should acknowledge the reality that there is a broad consensus that taxpayer dollars should not fund abortion. I urge my colleagues to join me in protecting innocent life by supporting my amendment. With that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back the balance of my time.
Jackie Walorski, Republican. During today's markup session, House Ways and Means Committee, opposing the amendment, Democrat Judy Chu of California.
I strongly oppose any effort to utilize a pandemic relief bill to further an anti-choice agenda that would add abortion restrictions to COBRA coverage. It would go beyond what is current law. This would dramatically expand abortion restrictions to private insurance coverage, which the federal government has never done. Rather than enhancing this proposal, this amendment will result in fewer Americans being able to access health insurance. A restriction like this would make it more difficult and in some states impossible to administer. In practice, this amendment would deny millions of former and furloughed employees access to the federal subsidies to purchase COBRA coverage because their former employer-sponsored plans include abortion coverage. COBRA is supposed to provide employees access to the same exact employer sponsor plan as when they were employed. Abortion is healthcare, and excluding abortion from COBRA coverage makes as little sense as excluding cancer coverage. And additional administrative burdens of implementing this policy would further delay when a laid off or furloughed employee could use the subsidies to purchase the COBRA coverage. We are in the middle of a raging pandemic for a disease that is infectious and could result in hospitalization. This amendment is so harmful because it would push insurance coverage further away from millions of unemployed workers looking to protect themselves and their families in order to further a radical anti-choice agenda.
Congresswoman Judy Chu, Democrat of California, during today's Ways and Means Committee markup session of the coronavirus economic aid bill, at least the portions of the bill that are under the committee's jurisdiction, which is quite a bit of the proposed $1.9 trillion. This amendment dealing with abortion offered by Republican Jackie Walorski of Indiana did not pass. This week on C-SPAN's podcast, The Weekly, a look at the U.S. relationship with NATO with Daniel Kochis, senior policy analyst in European affairs for the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. It's part of the Heritage Foundation. Here's a bit of it where he talks about former President Donald Trump wanting to cut U.S. forces from NATO.
So American presidents, both Republican and Democrats, have complained really since the inception of the organization that Europeans do not spend enough on defense. There's a famous quote from Dwight Eisenhower that Europeans are trying to make a sucker out of Uncle Sam. And you think about, you know, his role in really setting up NATO as the first supreme allied commander, saying something like that, it sounds like something that President Trump himself could have said. And so there's this mindset, I think, in the United States that these are large, wealthy countries with robust economies that have established welfare states. Why are they not spending adequate euros, on defense? And at some level, that's true. So in 2006, the organization came up with these benchmarks to spend 2% of GDP on defense, and within that 2% of GDP, to spend 20% of that on new equipment purchases and research and development. And many NATO allies were not hitting those targets. In fact, only a few of them were. And so today, in 2020, 10 of 30 countries, which includes the United States, was hitting its spending benchmarks. This is a significant improvement over a few years ago, where you just had four or five countries hitting the spending benchmarks, but still quite a bit needs to be done. And then there's also this sort of side discussion about the amount of money that the United States spends to maintain these large number of forces in Europe. Obviously, as we've talked about a little bit earlier in the discussion, it's many magnitudes lower than it was under the Cold War, but still the United States does base large numbers of troops in Europe and maintains basing. The reality is that European countries actually helped defray significantly the cost of that basing. So last year, for instance, the Germans put about $1 billion into helping maintain a U.S. basing in Europe. The Italians, the Belgians, the Dutch do the same. And it's true for also for allies in Asia. The Japanese and the Koreans really fund most of the infrastructure and the basing needs there.
Daniel Cochis, our guest this week on C-SPAN's podcast, The Weekly. You can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts starting Friday. And thank you for being with us today. This program, Washington Today, also available as a podcast. And download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen wherever you go. Hope you have a good night.